You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
On April 24th this year, Mumia Abu-Jamal marked his 57th birthday on death row, where he has been for the last nearly 29 years. And for 23 hours of every day for those nearly 29 years, he's been confined to isolation in a tiny cell. Internationally, Mumia is widely recognized as a political prisoner, unjustly convicted of the murder of a Philadelphia policeman in July 1982. The U.S. legal system continues to deny Mumia Abu-Jamal basic justice, yet on April 26th there was one positive development. And to explain this development, I'm joined on the phone by Lynn Washington. He's an award-winning journalist. He's also a professor of journalism at Temple University in Philadelphia. Lynn has followed Mumia's trials and tribulations for almost three decades. Welcome, Lynn, to Vancouver Cooperative Radio. It's a pleasure to have you.
It's a pleasure to be here. Hi.
When Mumia was convicted of murder in his 1982 trial, he was sentenced to death. What happened in this latest decision?
Well, the latest decision by the Federal Third Circuit Court of Appeals, that's an appellate court that sits basically right below the U.S. Supreme Court, they upheld a ruling that they made in 2008 that the death sentence that Mumia received was improper because the judge at that 1982 trial improperly instructed the jury on how to deliberate and also how to fill out death penalty verdict forms.
Now, that decision is part of what I refer to as a ping-pong game, I guess, between this appeal court in Philadelphia and the U.S. Supreme Court. Could you explain a little bit how this has been going back and forth?
Yes. In your introduction, you characterized the case accurately by saying that Mumia Abu-Jamal has been denied basic justice. One of the problems with what's going on now, where the U.S. Supreme Court says, well, we think the law is one way, and the Third Circuit says, no, based on your rulings, the Supreme Court, and our rulings and other rulings, the law is this way, is a part of this manifest denial of justice for Abu-Jamal. It's incredible that after nearly 30 years of litigation, that the case comes down to one single procedural error. Few people realize the context of this, that in Pennsylvania, since Abu-Jamal's conviction in 1982, well over 200 death sentences have been overturned by various courts, be they state courts or federal courts, for issues like ineffective assistance of counsel by the defense counsel at trial, prosecutorial misconduct, judicial bias, jury discrimination, selection, and things of that nature. All of the things that are in Mumia's case, but all of the things that the courts say don't exist. And that's one of the travesties with this particular matter.
What are the options now, given this most recent decision by the Federal Appellate Court? What could happen in relation to that? Because it all relates to the death sentence.
Yes, it all relates to the death sentence. And what the court specifically ordered was that if the prosecutors in Philadelphia, the district attorney is what they're called in Pennsylvania, if the prosecutors want to restore Abu-Jamal's death penalty, then they have to do a mini-trial where a new jury will be impaneled and they will decide whether he gets death or life in prison. There will be evidence presented, but not evidence that could win a new trial or evidence that would win a release. So it's just death or life in prison. If the prosecutors decide not to hold that kind of little mini trial, then Abu-Jamal's sentence will automatically become life in prison. And in Pennsylvania, life means life. You don't leave prison until you die. There's no chance of parole. And there's even lower chance of getting a pardon from the governor of Pennsylvania.
And there was some reference that the district attorneys, et cetera, in Pennsylvania might decide to appeal this decision again to the Supreme Court, where it's already once gone and been referred back.
Right. They decided that they would take the money-wasting and very expensive long shot to appeal. And when I say a long shot, the Supreme Court of the United States gets literally 10,000 appeals in a year, but they only select 300 or less for deliberation. So it's unlikely that they will take this case, and if they do, then it'll be years of more litigation, which is expense and cost. So yes, they said that they would appeal this, and that decision to appeal was based on the prosecutor calling the wife of the slain police officer and ask her if she wants to appeal. She said yes. She lives in California, so the tax money that's being wasted on this appeal doesn't impact her directly.
So, but the Supreme Court may decide, and most likely would decide, this isn't something they want to reconsider again and just ignore it, and therefore Mumia would be left without a death sentence, but in the same condition of being imprisoned until he dies.
Yes, he would be in prison. The only thing that would change, and it's small but significant given the circumstances of isolation, he would be taken off of death row, and he would be put in general population. And one of the immediate things that would happen in general population is that he would be able to have contact visits with his family. I mean, they could kiss him and hug him. He can touch them, something that he hasn't done with his wife, his children, and now his grandchildren, his brothers and his sisters, since he was arrested in December 9th, 1981. As I said, for a person in that sort of isolated circumstance, that is a significant change. However, he's still in prison, and that is the real tragedy and the real travesty.
Mumia, before he was imprisoned, was a community organizer. He was a radio broadcaster. He was a member of the Black Panthers. And since he's been imprisoned, he's written books. He's completed university degrees. He records regular commentaries for radio. Is this spirit of his, of resistance, the real crime for which he's been convicted and kept on death row these three decades?
Well, I think it's I think there's more than ample evidence to make the statement that his resistance, his activism on behalf of justice, as you may know, Mumia writes constantly. He's published all around the world every week, perhaps one of the most productive journalists in the whole world in terms of publication and airtime for broadcasting. He rarely talks about his case. But because he has continued to fight, I think it is very clear that it's become politically unpalatable for the courts to extend him justice, because to extend him justice would be a recognition that he has been horribly wronged, and to have that as a reality, that yes, we have horribly wronged this man, and yes, we are horribly wronging tens of thousands of others, is a concession, or more specifically, is a recognition of reality, a recognition of fact that the U.S. government and federal and court state system court systems do not want to make.
There, you mentioned in theory the governor of Pennsylvania has the prerogative of granting amnesty. In previous times, I know the outgoing president of the United States has a prerogative of granting amnesty. Some people who were advocating for that, for Leonard Peltier, who's been in prison so many decades too, were disappointed that that wasn't exercised. Are these theoretically still applicable in Mumia's case too, either presidential? You mentioned already the governor.
Yes, at both levels, at the presidential level and at the gubernatorial level, those chief executives have the inherent power, the discretionary power, to pardon or commute the sentence of anybody they so choose. The reality is that the issue of crime, and sadly the issue of justice in the United States, has been so impacted politically that it is literally politically unpalatable for executives to exercise that very compassionate and very righteous authority. As you mentioned, Leonard Peltier, the evidence is very clear that he was falsely convicted and he suffered horribly. And in a distinct difference from the Mumia case, Leonard Peltier was clearly arrested for his activism, and his initial prosecution was very classic in the sense of a political prisoner. Abu Jamal, subsequent to his incarceration, has taken on all of the characteristics of a political prisoner. But sadly, at the point of his arrest at 3 or 4 in the morning of December 9th, 1981, he was just a black guy on the street in Philadelphia sitting wounded next to a white police officer, and he would have been similarly persecuted if, in fact, he was some religious holy man or whatever. I mean, they just do those sorts of things to people. There were 4 other men that were horribly framed in 1981, including one who was falsely put on death row. So the unfairness of the Philadelphia Police Department, as well as the Philadelphia prosecutors and the justice system, for the better part, are not exclusive to Mumia.
It's one small glimmer of change and hope for that change. The Mumia will be able to have some contact with his family, and I'm sure he'll continue his political work. And the work against the prison industrial complex remains a task for all of us who are outside of those walls.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
Thank you, sir. Have a nice day. Bye-bye.
Bye. I've been speaking with Lynn Washington. He's an award-winning journalist and a professor of journalism at Temple University in Philadelphia. Lynn has followed Mumia's trials and tribulations for almost 3 decades.